WBUR.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In World Cup action early this morning, South Africa topped Slovenia 1-0, hence Slovenia will not advance. Croatia came back from a one-goal deficit to stun Italy 2-1. Today's third game pits Brazil against China. Later in the program, another look at Wednesday morning's excellent adventure. In the NBA Finals, the Los Angeles Lakers took another step toward the team's third championship in a row by beating the New Jersey Nets 106-83 last night. Shaquille O'Neal dropped in 40 points for the Lakers, giving him 76 over two games. LA now leads that series 2-0. Game three is set for tomorrow night in New Jersey. Despite the team's inability to contend with Shaquille O'Neal, New Jersey's first appearance in the NBA Finals has won the team some unlikely fans, New Yorkers accustomed to cheering for the Nets' near neighbors, the Knicks. John Kalish watched Game 1 of the championship series at a sports bar in Manhattan, and he has this report.
Inside the Time Out Bar on Manhattan's Upper West Side, the bartender is frantically pouring pitchers of beer as waitresses and busboys rush burgers and plates of chicken wings to customers on the bar's three different levels. Owner Stu Eisenberg is wearing a Knicks jersey with the name Sprewell emblazoned on the back.
Most of the people here are pulling for the Nets. But, you're New York. It's a melting pot. People come from every corner of the country to come watch their team.
Eisenberg's astute sociological analysis is borne out by a minority of Laker fans in the bar cheering heartily for every free throw sunk by Shaquille O'Neal. Though the cheers for Nets baskets are louder, the people doing the cheering are not, for the most part, folks who have ever ventured out to the swamp across the Hudson River where Jason Kidd and company hold court. Jay Martinez lives in the Bronx.
To be honest, I'm pretty much a Knicks fan on the Nets bandwagon because the Knicks are horrible right now. So I'm jumping on the Nets bandwagon. I like Jason Kidd much the same as I like Iverson last year. Kidd is my man this year because the Knicks are horrible. I'm still going to root for the Knicks and all, but, you know, you got to have something to cheer for. And if the Nets are in the finals, you know, more power to them. I'd like to see them do it.
Some of the Knicks fans cheering for the Nets do so not so much because they have a warm spot in their hearts for New Jersey and its basketball style, but because they detest the team from Los Angeles, its standout center and seemingly unstoppable guard Kobe Bryant. Here's New Yorker Seth Litt.
I'm a Knicks fan, but I hate Kobe, so, I mean, I root against anyone that was playing the Lakers. I've been rooting against the Lakers the whole playoffs, and I don't really like anything about New Jersey. My mom's from Jersey, and I still don't like Jersey. But between New Jersey and Kobe, I had to go with New Jersey.
Knicks fans turn Nets supporters barely bat an eye when their team loyalty is questioned. Michael Stevens points out that the Nets and Knicks don't have to vie for fans the way the Mets and Yankees traditionally have. Though Stevens seems to grasp the concept that only one of the two teams can represent the East in the NBA Finals. He insists that there can be amity between the two squads and their supporters.
I was born and raised in New York. I'm a Knicks fan. But the Nets and Jason Kidd have captured my heart. And I'm pulling for the Nets. They've won me over. I always hated the Celtics. I never hated the Nets. A lot of people think the Nets are the Knicks' rivals, but I don't think so. I think it's the Celtics. Nets and Knicks can coexist in harmony.
Mike Mirko has been a Knicks fan for 7 years, but he's one of the few on hand here who vows he's now done with the team.
I went to a 4 Nets game. I have a Kenyon Martin jersey. So, I don't know if that makes me a legitimate fan. It's good to just see the Nets. I mean, they turned around so quickly. I mean, last season they were basically garbage, and now they're in the NBA Finals. And it's a great story.
Game 3 of the NBA Finals will take place tomorrow night in East Rutherford, New Jersey, where the Nets hope to prevent the Lakers from taking a 3-0 series lead. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
In Paris today, Ms. Williams will win the French Open. The only question is, which Ms. Williams, Venus or Serena? And then tomorrow, Albert Costa will meet Juan Carlos Ferrero for the men's title. Here to discuss those matchups and the tournament that produced them is Bud Collins, speaking to me by phone from Paris. Bud, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, merci. I won't speak any more French.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Not because your French is bad, but because I wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Well, neither would I, so it's an even Stephen.
In your column yesterday, you called the women's final a Richard Williams bedtime story that's come true, and you quoted Venus Williams saying, and here I'm quoting, "Here we are at the top of the world, a small world, but it's real nice." Quite a sense of perspective in that characterization of pro tennis as a small world, don't you think?
I was a little taken by it myself, but I think these are very level-headed kids and very bright, too. And I think they know where they are in the world. They like the celebrity part, and they like being in magazines and on television and everywhere, but they see it for what it is.
Interesting that not too long ago, Richard Williams suggested that maybe it was about time for Venus to retire and find something more significant than tennis to which she could devote her talents.
Papa Williams knows how to get a headline or two, and he's very adept at that. But I would like people also to notice the influence their mother, Ora Sehn, has been. She just sits there, never changes expression, and is really, you know, people like me used to say when the Williams started getting to be top 10 players, well, now they really need professional coaching help. They need somebody to take them to the next level. We weren't really very satisfied with this mom and pop arrangement of two people who really had no background in tennis, but it's worked out pretty well, hasn't it?
But it's interesting to me that Venus and Serena Williams having become number one and two in the world, it's the first time that two African-Americans have done this, and yet that's not what people are talking about. They're just talking about what great players they are, and this would seem to me a sign of considerable progress.
Well, I think it really is. They're the only two sisters who have ever done it, and it is progress, and I think they'll inspire more kids to play, more kids of color, just more kids, because they're such fun.
Venus has had the edge when the two sisters have played, but it was Serena who knocked off the defending champ this time. Is one of the sisters currently playing any better than the other?
I think Serena is playing a little better. She is winning the dressing race, according to Venus. She's already worn an outfit that resembles the Cameroonian football outfit with high socks. She said that was too hot to wear after a couple of matches. So Venus says, yes, Serena is ahead in fashion. You know, Serena is a blonde this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, is that because gentlemen prefer blondes or that blondes have more fun? And she said, a little of each. And I said, well, you decided this year. But she said, well, no, I'm a natural blonde. So she is great fun. But I think Serena is playing just a little better. She's been pressed harder, of course, that match with Capriati when she was 4 points from defeat, serving at 5-6 in the second set. And she has beaten Capriati now five straight. And she beat Venus, most importantly, I think, in the semifinals at Key Biscayne. And she said then that removed a mental block.
Mm-hmm.
And Venus said there was no mental block, so they disagree on that one. But I think it did remove a mental block. And now on clay, a surface that everyone said was not to their liking, and indeed, Venus lost in the first round last year. So if she were to win the championship, that would be a great feat. But they've taken to clay just like they've taken to everything else. They try it for a while, and they just get right into it.
But before we discuss the men's finalists...
Are they playing the men?
There will be a men's final, absolutely, in a day or so. But earlier in the week, the men's side of the tournament produced a story that I'm sure you enjoyed. Andre Pavel took advantage of a rain delay to fly to Germany to witness the birth of his son. And when he returned to Paris, Alex Correia beat him. No sentimentalist Mr. Correia, I gather.
No, not at all. And in fact, they thought Pavel was saved, in a sense, by rain the next day after they had stopped their match at darkness, and he would have been defaulted if he hadn't been able to come back. He drove all night to get back. He wanted to play. He didn't want to be defaulted. He wanted to do the right thing by the tournament as well as his wife, but it was clear that family came first.
The men's final will be a battle between two guys regarded as unlikely finalists when this tournament began. How is it that at the French Open, the top women generally do as well as they're expected to do and the top men don't?
I can't answer that, really, but there have been a lot of upsets. I really thought Andre Agassi was going to win the tournament, and the match he lost to Ferrero really would have been a terrific final. He came very close to going ahead by 2-1, but couldn't quite make it. This Ferrero is a tough cookie, and Andre at 32 is awfully difficult himself, but that would have been a marvelous final. Instead, I'm afraid we've got a couple of Spanish grinders, and it could go all day long.
Well, do you like the number 11 seed Juan Carlos Ferrero or the number 20 seed Albert Costa when they get to it?
Well, I'm picking Costa. I don't know why, because Ferrero is so tough, and he beat Murat Safin in the semifinals. But somehow I think Costa is destined because he, too, has a little romantic story going for him. He's going to be married next Friday, and Correia, the man he beat, will be his best man. And on his match point, when Costa hit a winner that he didn't see because he fell on his face in the dirt, his future bride, who is also the mother of their twin daughters, said she hopes he doesn't fall on his face at the altar.
Bud Collins writes about tennis for the Boston Globe, and he lends his expertise to Only a Game from time to time. Thank you, Bud.
Thank you, Bill.
Give Paris one more chance. Let's wrap it up. Yeah.
Well, well, well.
Well, if you've been to cities, but you've had enough. Have you been to Paris, France? And if you doubt that Paris was made for love, give Paris one more chance. The home of Piaf and Charles Aznavour must have done something right, and she'll do something more. If you don't think Paris was made for love, give Paris one more chance. All right, give Paris one more chance.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Tim Kulka, a spokesperson for Kaiser's drugstore chain in Hamm, Germany, began to feel, as he said, a little queasy at halftime of the German national team's first World Cup game. He wasn't afraid the German side would lose. He was afraid it would win by too much. Kaiser's Drugs had offered to reduce the price on a popular line of cosmetic products by 5% for each German goal. At the half, Germany led Saudi Arabia by 4-0. The final score was 8-0, so shower gels and so on went for 40% off this week at Kaiser's. Happily for the drugstore chain's bottom line, Ireland held the Germans to only one goal on Wednesday when the two sides played to a draw.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tensions are rising in South Asia today after Pakistan shot down an unmanned Indian spy plane. To read more, go to WBUR.org and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. Nixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses, with offices in the East and in California, and on the web at nixonpeabody.com. And the 24th Cambridge River Festival, the Cambridge Arts Council's outdoor celebration of the arts, Saturday, June 15th from noon to 6 on Memorial Drive between Central and Harvard Squares. Information at cambridgeartscouncil.org. The weather forecast, lots of sunshine today, highs in the mid-60s, clouding up tonight. A chance of showers tomorrow afternoon, but it will be warmer and more humid. In Boston now, 51 degrees and 51 in Hyannis. At 720, this is WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, how the vicar at St. Luke's of Eccles Hill in Yorkshire is handling World Cup fever. But first, it must be a lovely time to be Spanish. Spain's national team, notorious for underachieving at the World Cup, became the first side to go through to the second round by accumulating two wins in the first round. Nigeria, laboring in the group of death, and Saudi Arabia were the first two teams to be eliminated from the next round. But in the U.S., the soccer story of the tournament and perhaps the decade, if not all ruddy time, was Wednesday morning's result, USA 3, Portugal 2. The U.S. next plays South Korea. That game will be at 2:25 a.m. Eastern time on Monday. So right after this program is over, get some sleep so you'll be ready. But back to wonders already accomplished. Only a Game's Ken Shulman watched the U.S. team's remarkable victory over Portugal at Casa do Benfica, a Portuguese club in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he has this report.
It was as unexpected as a shark attack, as devastating as an earthquake. Barely 4 minutes into their World Cup opener against the USA, and Portugal was down 1-0. At halftime, Portugal trailed 3-1. At the Casa do Benfica fan club in East Cambridge, Massachusetts, a cloud of gloom engulfed the Portuguese faithful who'd come at 5 a.m. to watch the match.
They're just playing lousy. I never seen them play this lousy, especially the number two. He's not marking anybody. He's totally out of position. And I'm surprised they lose just 2-3-1. I mean, truly 4-1 at this time.
The best team Portugal had fielded in a decade was about to fall to a bunch of American upstarts. Yet as the final seconds ticked away, with the Spanish-language play-by-play announcer calling the match one of the biggest upsets in World Cup history, the crowd at Benfica was inexplicably joyous.
The eagle has landed! Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! I love underdogs!
For the Portuguese-American community, the U.S.-Portugal World Cup match created a conflict between past and present. There are over 2 million people of Portuguese descent in the United States. Most live in closely knit communities in the Northeast or in California. These communities endure by preserving their language, cuisine, and culture. And one of the most important parts of that culture is soccer.
I set the alarm clock to
The Casa do Benfica is a hangout for fans of Benfica, Portugal's most successful professional soccer club. The Portuguese of Greater Boston come here after work to drink beer, play cards, shoot pool, and most of all to watch Portuguese soccer on satellite TV. There are Benfica clubs across the globe, anywhere people of Portuguese origin have settled. Luis Mota is bar manager at the East Cambridge Casa do Benfica. An immigrant from Portugal's Azores Islands, Mota says that love of soccer holds this community together.
You know, we come to America to work, you know, make a better life. So we to get together, we make clubs. We got a lot of clubs in Cambridge. We got about 10 clubs, Portuguese clubs.
Are they all football clubs?
I think except one, Santo Cristo, is like a religions thing. You know, all the other ones are soccer clubs.
I don't mean to be sacrilegious, but does that mean that soccer is as important as religion?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the people from Azores, they are religion. They like to go to church and too, but they like soccer, so soccer, I think, is number one.
Portugal is a small and relatively poor country, one whose inhabitants have often had to emigrate in search of work. Even today, almost a third of Portugal's 10 million citizens live abroad. A history of hard lives, long journeys at sea, and absence has left an indelible mark on the national character. In Portuguese, that mark is called saudade. Frank Souza is director of the Center for Portuguese Studies and Culture at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. In typical Portuguese fashion, Souza spoke of saudade while boarding a Lisbon-bound plane at Boston's Logan Airport.
You know, it's that vague longing for the past, for loss, that which is lost. And so there's an obsession with it in Portuguese culture. I mean, it's a real obsession. People are very nostalgic. And so it's a word that, for the Portuguese, it almost defines being Portuguese.
Like Souza, who emigrated with his family at age 9, the majority of New England's Portuguese community can trace its roots back to the Azores Islands. Souza's great-grandfather arrived in New England as a stowaway. In the 1850s, he made his way across the continent to prospect gold in California. Subsequent generations of the Souza family also emigrated, returning to the 9-island Portuguese archipelago to retire. As a boy in the Azores, midway in the Atlantic between Portugal and the New World, Souza listened to his relatives' American tales with wonder. Born Francisco, now known as Frank, Souza usually lives his double life well. The Azorean island of St. George, the feasts of the Pentecost, and playing soccer in the streets are parts of his rich past. His scholarly work, his teaching job, and his family are parts of his rich present. It's only moments like Portugal-USA that make him feel saudade.
I feel conflicted. For me, it's a real conflict, actually, because I'm always on the U.S. side in terms of sports. And this is a moment when I'm divided between wanting the underdog to win and wanting the team that I've been following since a child to win.
The town of New Bedford has one of the highest concentrations of Portuguese in the country. Nearly half of its 100,000 inhabitants are Luso-Americans. Islanders from the Azores first arrived on whaling ships in the 18th century and continued to flock to the Massachusetts port through the 1960s. New Bedford no longer has the thriving economy it enjoyed when Herman Melville set the beginning of Moby Dick here in 1851. Today, the town has the highest unemployment rate in the state. Acushnet Ave, once Portuguese New Bedford's main thoroughfare, is now home to Central American markets and empty storefronts, as well as to Portuguese bars, restaurants, and soccer clubs. Yet the Portuguese community still preserves its roots. It's not uncommon for third and fourth generation Portuguese to speak that language fluently. New Bedford has a powerful Portuguese language radio station, a 24/7 cable television show, and, of course, a Portuguese soccer league.
We know soccer is important for the Europeans, you know, as a form of entertainment, it's like a passion.
Manuel Ferreira is editor of the Portuguese Times, a Portuguese weekly newspaper with a circulation of 15,000. The 60-year-old immigrant says the Portuguese, like most Europeans, have a deep-rooted love of soccer. But he also says that for those Portuguese of his generation, who lived under the oppressive regime of Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, soccer, like America, represents something much more important than their lost youth. It represents freedom.
In Portugal at that time, soccer, since we lived on a dictatorship, soccer was the only public manifestation. It was encouraged by the government. Soccer and not necessarily the fight, but our little family, religion and soccer. So, in a sense, soccer was a very democratic institution. In Portugal, we have elections. That wasn't an election for anything else, but we have elections for the soccer association.
There's a saying among Portuguese soccer fans that fans can change their wives, they can change their cars, but they'll never change their loyalties. Like most Portuguese Americans, Ferreira plans to root for the land of his birth until he dies, even when it plays against the U.S., the country where he plans to be buried. It's not a war, he says, it's sport. And besides, he added, on the eve of last Wednesday's USA-Portugal match, the U.S. was bound to lose anyway.
But I will be surprised if the United States win. We'll be an upset. Won't you be surprised if the United States win?
For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
England's opening match in World Cup play occurred on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. United Kingdom time, a circumstance that led to concern among some clergy that attendance might be down at services. The Reverend John Hartley of St. Luke's in Eccles Hill is among those who came up with creative solutions to the potential conflict. Reverend Hartley joins me now from home in Bradford, England. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Well, it's very nice to have you. Tell us how you responded to the fact that England played at 10:30 on a Sunday morning.
Well, I had a couple of ladies in the congregation come up to me and observe that their husbands would be in a difficult position of having to choose either to watch the match or else to come to church. And I thought, isn't that a shame? So what we decided to do was to move the church service to the afternoon, and we held it at 3 p.m. our time so that people could watch the football in the morning and then have the traditional Sunday lunch, and then they could come to church in the afternoon, and we had a Jubilee celebration tea because, of course, it's the Queen's Silver Jubilee.
All manner of things going on there, yes.
That's right.
Now, you spoke of two ladies that you'd talked to. Would attendance have been way down, do you suppose, if you'd held services at the regularly scheduled time?
Well, I think they would, really. I think I would have put a good number of chaps in a difficult position, really. There were a number of people who came up to me and said that actually they had appreciated the opportunity to be able to watch the football match. On the other hand, there are quite a lot of ladies who thought, isn't this a bit ridiculous? Why do the men have to get so excited about something which is, after all, only a game?
Well, an excellent point, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, some of the other ministers in the United Kingdom, I understand, actually had large TV screens installed in their churches so that people, I don't know whether they saw the game before or after services, but do you have one of those there at St. Luke's?
No, we didn't. Actually, one of my neighbouring churches did do that. They have an earlier service, and they started in time to get the whole thing over before the match started, and then they were all able to watch the match in at leisure. Nobody, so far as I know, actually had the match on during the church service. I think that would have been a bit difficult.
I understand, though, that there was one service where the minister had somebody stationed somewhere in the back of the church with a TV, and he was supposed to signal when England scored or something like that?
Well, I read about that in the newspaper. I don't know how it went. You can just imagine. Actually, I had several different sermons up my sleeve for what the scoreline would be, so that I could use different ones according to what the score came out on the final analysis. So I was able to tailor it a bit like that. But I dread to think what it would have been like if you'd had somebody signalling and you suddenly had to adapt the service and get this goal in. That would have been very difficult, wouldn't it?
I would think it would be a real challenge, absolutely. Now, but this is tough. You came in prepared with several different versions of a sermon. I hope that the version that you were able to deliver was, in fact, your favorite. I hope the English team cooperated.
Well, not quite. I was hoping that they would win about 3-1 because my sermon was entitled Make Jesus the Center Forward of Your Life. And I had three good reasons for doing that. And I also had one sort of question about it, which is, roughly speaking, what's the cost of commitment and that. And so it would have been nice if the score had been 3-1 so that I could have three positive points and one for the opposition. But as it happened, it was a 1-1 draw, so that was a bit difficult. So my eventual sermon was Make Jesus the Center Forward of Your Life because you'll find that he can place things in your life just exactly right for you to be able to score. That was what happened in the first half. But then, of course, at half-time, our centre-forward got tired and he had to retire, and the opposition scored in the second half. So the second part of my sermon was, if you make Jesus the centre-forward of your life, then he'll never get tired, and so the opposition will never score against you. That was the best I could do, Bill.
Now, there's one final thing. Your sermon was entitled Make Jesus the Center Forward of Your Life, and I understand that you also wrote a hymn which had the same title, to be sung to the tune of the theme for the TV program Match of the Day.
Yes, that's right. Yes, we have a very well-known TV program, Match of the Day, with a very well-known signature tune. And one of the local clergy on our diocesan email chat group said, can anybody write some Christian words to it? So I wrote them for a bit of a laugh, and we decided to use them in the service. So we did that. Do you want me to sing it to you, then?
I would love that.
Yeah, well, it goes like this. How great is God, the Lord Almighty, who has made all things well. How great is Jesus Christ, the Saviour, who rescues us from hell. How great is God, the Holy Spirit, who makes us want to tell. We've a great and mighty three in one, his praises we will yell. And then there are another two verses to follow it.
I like that song's chances, assuming, of course, that England goes through. I see it shooting right to the top.
Well, don't hold your breath, like I said before. Yeah, we shall just have to see, shan't we? Of course, you know, in the church, we do believe that God is the God of all nations. So, I mean, it wouldn't be right for us to pray for a British victory in the World Cup. But I do pray that all the teams will do themselves justice. And I do pray that everybody will have a good time and there won't be any violence.
The Reverend John Hartley is the vicar of St. Luke's Church at Eccles Hill in Yorkshire. Reverend Hartley, thank you very much for speaking with me, and may your congregation be large and optimistic about the prospects in Japan and all other things as well.
It's nice to speak to you, Bill. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. Regarding our program of 2 weeks ago, Bill Sudol, a listener from Omaha, Nebraska, wrote to say, I am appalled at the negative comments about Sam Snead's reputation. Yes, he was a gambler, but he was a role model and one of the greats. Robert Kersting, who hears Only a Game on WFPL in Louisville, wrote of that show, who is this Charlie clown and why was he yelling at me at 7:45 in the morning? I always thought this show had a little class. Robert Brown, a WBUR listener, emailed to say, I only reluctantly listen to your radio show. My significant other is the sports fan, not I. But I am very impressed about how much Dead Kennedys music you play on your show, that being my favorite band ever. Keep up the good work, and I may just continue to listen to your show. We also heard from Grady Klein in Princeton, New Jersey, in response to the conversation I had a couple of weeks ago concerning the book Ultimate Golf. When I awoke Saturday morning, I heard the phrase presumptuous to call a game ultimate, and I presumed with bated breath and a fluttering heart that you were going to talk about my favorite game, ultimate. But instead you talked about golf, which is okay, but it's not ultimate. Actually, we ran a couple of pieces on that sport when it was still called Ultimate Frisbee. Among the other dodges, listeners have recently urged us to cover, or cover more thoroughly, our ultra-running, rugby, bicycle competitions in Italy, women's gymnastics, and automobile racing. But John Servino of Santa Clara, California, emailed to say, quote, "Your mix of stories and commentaries, your honest, upbeat, and often humorous, quirky style, and your guests are a breath of fresh air." Huh. That might be a good name for a program. The emailers who think I talk about soccer too much appear to about equal in number those who don't think I talk about it enough. Finally, John Koenig emailed to say, quote, "I really must commend you on the golf piece with Chip McGrath and Ward Just. That was some of the most entertaining radio I've heard in quite a while. Is it normal to be laughing out loud while driving alone? Gee, I hope so. It happens to me all the time." Should you wish to email your comments to us, our address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also reach us by email through our website, onlyagame.org. We live at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can record your comments by calling the listener line at 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for over 10 years. Detailed information on current computer virus threats available at sophos.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by UR listeners and by Century 21 Fine Homes and Estates. More information on their luxury listings is available at century21.com/MA. Century 21, real estate for the real world. And Direct Tire and Auto Service, with locations in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. Information available at 1-800-TIRE-PRO or online at directtire.com. Good morning, I'm Bob C., and it's a big sports weekend. The Red Sox take on the world champion Arizona Diamondbacks this afternoon. Pedro Martinez facing off against Curt Schilling at Fenway Park. The Sox lost to Arizona last night 7-5. In the NBA Finals, the Lakers have taken a 2-0 lead over the Nets. In Game 2 with a 106-83 win last night, Game 3 will be played in New Jersey tomorrow night. The Stanley Cup Finals will be played in North Carolina for the first time as the Hurricanes host the Red Wings in Game 3 of the series this evening. That series is tied at one game apiece, and the stage is set for tonight's heavyweight battle between Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis. And the Triple Crown Hopeful War Emblem races in the Belmont Stakes today. If you're searching for ideas for something to do this weekend, check out our arts calendar. You'll find listings for gallery exhibits, music events, book readings, and more. It's on the web at WBUR.org. The weather forecast, sunny today, highs in the mid-60s. Right now in Boston, it's 52 degrees at 7:39.
Father's Day is just around the corner, and today only, WBUR is giving you a chance to do something special for your dad while helping to pay for the news. Your $100 pledge today will get a copy of Scott Simon's book, Home and Away, sent to your dad in time for Father's Day. And enter your name in a drawing to win brunch with Scott. Order before tonight's deadline at WBUR.org or call 800-909-9287. And thanks.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, speculation about speculators and horseflesh, in particular, War Emblem's owner. But first, here to review the week's veritable sports banquet is Only a Game's gourmand, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Let's begin with the Stanley Cup Finals. The Carolina Hurricanes split the first two games, both of which were in Detroit. The series resumes tonight in Raleigh. Should we be surprised that the mighty Canes have averted a sweep?
We would have been really surprised if they had managed to hang on and sneak a goal and take two in Detroit. I think the whole series pivoted on one great save that Dominic Hasek made on Bates Battaglia, one of the great post-Fitzgeraldian names in the history of hockey. It wasn't like a typical Hasek standing on your head save. He played classic goalie. A centering pass came out to the left post, and he slid over and took the corner away. And at that moment, the Carolina would have gone up 2-1, and Detroit would have been, you know, doing their Mr. Ed impression with each other. They came back, scored twice. It's 3-1. I suspect this will be over in 4 or 5 games.
World Cup action is competing for the attention of TV viewers.
Exactly.
I don't want any smart-ass comments because, by golly, this time it's true. The U.S. team's astonishing victory over Portugal on Wednesday has increased interest here. I don't think that can be denied. But the next U.S. game occurs at 2:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Monday. I guess ESPN's clout wasn't enough to convince FIFA to schedule the match at a better time.
Well, now, the key is not to get up at 2 o'clock to watch the game. The key is not to go to bed.
Mm-hmm. Those who dislike soccer may cite the example of Brazil's Rivaldo falling down, clutching his head after being hit in the leg by a ball. He was fined for simulation and warned not to do that again. This is not something other pro athletes have to worry too much about.
Well, there's a little bit of it in basketball, and there is always the I'll get you, you dirty swine, acting if you get hit in, like, the nether regions by a slow curveball by somebody and you decide you want to start a bench-clearing discussion. This guy is really bad, though. This Rivaldo guy, I've watched him. This guy is really, really terrible. I mean, the head, the chest, the arms. I mean, he's gotten his way to the ground. He looks like Fred Sanford talking to Lamont. Oh, Elizabeth, it's the big one.
As if there's not enough else going on in sports this weekend, we also got that relatively rare circumstance of potential Triple Crown winner. Neither of us liked War Emblem after he won the Derby. How do you feel about him now that he's won the Preakness and he's going for the Triple Crown?
He's never going anywhere, this horse. you know, he's beating the field like a drum in both races. Again, you know, the mile and a half at the Belmont is a real test. It's my favorite horse race. Why not pick him? I mean, I want to see a Triple Crown winner. I haven't seen one in a while. There is no living Triple Crown winner now, as
That's right.
Good friend Seattle Slew passed a few weeks ago. So why not? We need a Triple Crown winner. He might as well be it.
Can you think of anything to say about tonight's show, perhaps involving Lennox Lewis and Mike Tyson, assuming Mike Tyson actually does climb into the ring? I say show, obviously, Charlie, because I'm beyond calling anything Mike Tyson participates in a sporting event.
Well, it is a sporting event. Once again, I have said my position from the start has been I will believe this fight when the first bell rings and they're both in the ring. I have a tremulous feeling that I got last weekend watching a completely over-the-hill Evander Holyfield beat and create a strange alien-like thing on the top of the head of Abdul Rahman.
That was quite hideous.
That Mike Tyson may actually win this fight. Because for Lennox Lewis to have been knocked silly by a pathetic tomato can like Abdul Rahman is a disgrace. I think Mike Tyson may very well hit Lennox Lewis cleanly and knock him out.
I'm sure that you weren't surprised to learn this week that Magic Johnson had been voted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. If there is such a thing as a lock, he certainly was it. But I'm wondering if some of the other honorees did surprise you.
Well, I think it was really nice to have Drazen Petrovic into the Hall of Fame because he really was the trailblazer for all the other people you see, all the other, particularly the Eastern Europeans that you see playing in the mm-hmm. NBA now. He was a great guy, terrific shooter, died much too soon in an automobile accident. The Harlem Globetrotters is an interesting pick.
I thought so, too.
Because while they have brought basketball, Lord knows, to all parts of literally the globe, their place in American social and cultural history is a little bit dicier, particularly when you recall that Abe Saperstein, who owned the Harlem Globetrotters, was the primary force against the racial integration of the National Basketball Association.
Right.
This is a very intriguing pick. I'll be very interested to see who goes up there to represent the Globies.
This week, U.S. Congressman Tom Osborne, among others...
Wait, let's run that by us again, okay? Say that again, because...
You wish to hear U.S. Congressman Tom Osborne?
Hey, I've got used to U.S. Congressman Sonny Bono. I can get used to anything.
This week, U.S. Congressman Tom Osborne, among others, rallied for legislation that would punish agents who break rules made by the NCAA. Unhappily for the former Nebraska football coach, support for that plan does not appear to be entirely unanimous. I would offer an analogy here, but I think I'll leave it to you.
Well, no, I mean, this is the College Football Coaches Protection Act. there's absolutely no reason in the world why we should pass a law in the Congress of the United States to help the NCAA do its business. This should die a quick and painful death, and Congressman Osborne, I love saying that, should go back to the fishing hole.
Finally, Charlie, though Scotland is not participating in this year's World Cup, Scottish football fans have been demonstrating their allegiances through the purchase of wine, Argentinian wine. That strategy did not work as England beat Argentina 1-0 on Friday. Maybe Scots should have stuck with what they know.
Well, the Scots seem to be like they're drinking a lot of Japanese beer and they're drinking a lot of Guinness and a lot of Murphy Stout. We're concluding here basically that Scottish people drink a lot when they're watching football. I, for one, am not stunned by this.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine as well as Esquire Magazine. He's a regular here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Away, 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 away.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. This afternoon, War Emblem, winner of the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, will try to take his place among such champions as Seattle Slew and Affirmed in a club composed of just 11 members, the winners of Thoroughbred Racing's Triple Crown. War Emblem's owner is Prince Ahmed Salman of Saudi Arabia, who bought the horse just before the Kentucky Derby. Joining me now from the NPR Bureau in New York to discuss the acquisition of War Emblem and other circumstances pertaining to this afternoon's race is Jason Levine, the author of a new book entitled From the Desert to the Derby. Jason, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me.
Your book actually focuses on Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the Crown Prince of Dubai, who vowed 4 years ago to win the Kentucky Derby within 4 years, and then his chief rival, Prince Ahmed Salman of Saudi Arabia, got there first. How did he do that?
Yeah, kind of ironic, isn't it? You put yourself out there, and then the one person in the world you hate most to see beat you beats you when you're supposed to win it yourself. Sheikh Mohammed badly wants to win the Kentucky Derby. He wants to publicize Dubai. That is what I discovered in the course of the book. He's won every big race in Europe, but he knows that the Kentucky Derby is the big one. And in fact, I think today's interview proves that. We're talking about this because War Emblem won the Derby, won the Preakness, and is now going for the Triple Crown. And that's the kind of publicity Sheikh Mohammed is looking for. To see his arch rival, Prince Salman, get that, and to see him get it just 3 weeks prior to the Derby is really a knife in the back. It's a body blow to Sheikh Mohammed. So I think there's some tremendous irony in this Triple Crown in that respect.
It's been said that the celebration following the Kentucky Derby this year was, quote, muted, as those celebrations go. Why was that?
There's a few reasons. Number one, the fact that the horse was purchased 3 weeks before the race really is not a story that the $2 bettor can get behind at all. I mean, it's a classic case of the rich getting richer. It's just not something you or I or many of the 140,000 people that day at Churchill Downs can really commiserate with. We just don't know what it's like to be able to dump $1 million in 3 weeks before the race just so you can have a horse. Prince Salman wanted to have a horse in the race, wanted to give himself an opportunity to be there, go to the parties, enjoy the scene, have a chance to win, and look what happened. In addition, Prince Salman is a difficult individual because he is unwilling to discuss his role vis-a-vis 9/11. He says he's just a businessman when in truth he's far more than that. He's a very influential publisher in Saudi Arabia, one of the most influential. So he's been a little bit misleading in some of his comments. I don't think that thrills people. Really, I was there, and there was almost a stunned silence when the horse crossed the finish line, which is very rare at the Derby. Not a lot of people bet on him, and not a lot of people knew who he was, and when they found out, they weren't exactly thrilled about his connections.
To be fair, in terms of the business of buying the horse 3 weeks before the Kentucky Derby, both Prince Salman and Sheikh Mohammed have bought lots of two-year-olds as well as lots of yearlings, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they buy horses all the time. That's how you have to get a horse. You either breed them yourself, which they both do, and or you buy yearlings. The difference with this one is the timing.
Right.
It's the first time in history that a Derby winner has been purchased less than a month before the race, and that really gives a different twist, to the story. It's not a feel-good story. This is no way to spin it to where it's really a very positive thing. It's just a story of a rich guy who was unable to get one of his other horses there and decided, hey, I want a date for the dance. I need to be there. He and his trainer, Bob Baffert, who has a great eye for horses and deserves a lot of credit, saw this horse run a great race, and they thought, you know what? He's for sale. Let's go check him out. They did. They saw that he might have had some physical problems, and they decided to overlook that in light of the fact that he was a talented horse, and they wanted to take their shot. They took their shot. They scored beyond their wildest dreams. They kept the horse together for 2 weeks. He won the Preakness, which was just a huge bonus for them, and now here we stand on the edge of history.
Well, what about the folks who sold War Emblem just before the Derby? I would think that they would be second-guessing themselves something fierce at this point.
Yeah, there's really mixed feelings there because they were not planning on running the horse in the Derby. These are small-time connections in context. They've had a lot of horses, but they've never had any really truly great horses. And they knew this horse had a lot of talent, but they thought he'd be better suited for the Preakness, which was one of the reasons that the Prince and Baffert were able to buy him. I'm going to say on one hand, they didn't quite know what they had. On another hand, they were a little bit mismanaging the horse and not trying for the Derby. As we saw, he clearly was good enough. On the other hand, they made a lot of money.
$900,000 they made, which sounds like a lot of money to me, certainly. But in the context of what these fellas generally spend on completely unproven horses, not all that much money to buy a horse that wins the Derby and the Preakness and has a shot at the Triple Crown.
Well, for Prince Salman, no. The $900,000 is not a lot of money. However, for the gentleman that sold him, Russell Reinemann, it is a large chunk of change. And that's far more than he's ever gotten for any horse, and it's far more than any of his horses have ever earned in their career. So that's one of the reasons he went ahead and did it. He also got percentage of the bonus, and he's eligible for a percentage of this other bonus if they win. So he's going to reap over $1 million. He still owns 10% of the horse, too. So if the horse gets sold into syndication, which I'm sure he will, for $15 million, he's going to get another $1.5 million. So I'm not crying too many tears for Russell Reinemann.
Is the fact that two very wealthy men, one from Saudi Arabia, the other from Dubai, are competing with each other for the greatest prizes in horse racing in the U.S. necessarily a bad thing for thoroughbred racing here? Because it certainly seems to be a very nice situation for folks with horses to sell.
You're exactly right on the second part of the comment. It's a great situation for people with horses to sell. Sheikh Mohammed and his brothers have been buying them since 1980, and in a few years they single-handedly propped up the Kentucky breeding industry. I mean, they are by far the largest buyers in the history of the sport. So in that sense, it's absolutely good for the sport. Sheikh Mohammed even has a group of older horses stabled in New York now that we're going to be hearing an awful lot from over the course of the summer. A horse named Street Cry, who may be the best older horse in training, and quite a few others, in addition to the two-year-olds that he hopes win next year's Derby. So, no, between the two of them, they have a large number of extraordinarily talented horses, and we're going to get to see those horses run, so that's a plus as well.
Most people did not think War Emblem would win the Kentucky Derby. He didn't go in as a favorite, and even winning the Derby didn't convince a lot of people that he would win the Preakness. You've followed this horse and his relatively recent owner for some time. Do you like War Emblem this afternoon?
No. I kind of wish I did. I really would like to see a Triple Crown winner. I was there in 1978 when Affirmed beat Alidar, and it was, if not the most, one of the two or three most exciting sporting experiences I've ever had. That was just a phenomenal example of athleticism and heart to see those two horses come down the stretch together, and Affirm just would not let Alidar by. I will give War Emblem this. He seems to have that kind of a heart. He does not want to let horses by him. And that may be what what wins it for him, because he's going to be challenged early, he's going to be challenged in the middle, and he's going to be challenged at the end of the race, much like he was in the Preakness. He was up to the task in the Preakness. That's a much shorter distance. I just have this feeling inside that he's not going to be able to harness the speed well enough to have enough at the end to hold off the closing charge. I think a horse named Sunday Break and another horse named Perfect Drift are the two that I fear are going to be charging past him in the final 200 yards.
Jason Levine is the author of From the Desert to the Derby, published by Daily Racing Form Press. Jason, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Manoli Wetherill at NPR in New York, and we also had help from Kevin Brady, Calvin Rivers, Kelvin Brooks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter, or take in a big World Cup match at La Casa do Benfica, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Reverend John Hartley, who wishes that two other teams had qualified for the World Cup tournament.
Wouldn't it have been lovely if India and Pakistan had both been able to play on the field, and they might have been able to settle their differences instead of by having a million soldiers lined up against each other?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Strategic Science and Technologies Incorporated, creators of Warm Cream, a patented cream for relief of cold hands and feet, naturally. Available on the web, warmcream.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.
Public Radio.
This is WB.